Okay, so this will be an opportunity for anyone to share their memories, thoughts of Joko, of working with Joko, of their practice connected to reading Joko's work. You're free to say something if you want, or not to say anything. I ask that you just let whoever's speaking complete what they have to say. I will be recording it unless you don't want it recorded, in which case just say I don't want it recorded, and I'll stop that, because if we record it, it's an opportunity for those who are not here to post it on the website. We'll continue until everyone's had whatever chance they want. We won't go in any particular order, so it's up to you to volunteer when, so to speak, the spirit moves you. If you need to use the restroom during the time, please feel free, and don't feel that you have to sit in any particular posture according to your circumstances. Adjust yourself. I think I've said everything that needs to be said.
Can we slow that one down a little bit? I think that's kind of noisy.
It's the air conditioner that's making the noise. I can turn that off.
No.
That's making a noise.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yep.
The fan.
It's the fan.
Yeah, if we just turn the fan off.
Oh, that's better.
You could turn that fan off completely, because the air conditioner will be fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he came back a few days later and said that I passed along their request, and she wants me to ask you why, which was probably better than going and seeing her, because it made, at least me, I won't speak for others who were part of that group, it made me look at why. What was I looking for? What did I expect? What did I expect out of from a teacher in general in that regard, or from myself? And it was just kind of surprising to me that just a few words from someone so far away is teaching how it touches so many people in just these little ways. It's very amazing to me. And I really didn't care that much for her style of teaching when I read her books. I was really into the mystery and the alienness and the sexiness of Zen. You know, and what she was offering was just so down to earth. he kept telling me to look at things that I was really not interested in, things I would rather avoid. And insisting that that's what practice is all about, and I thought it was about something else completely. And I guess the last thing I could say, my limited knowledge of her, is that I feel very strongly that this teacher and this sangha, this practice, is how she lives on. However you want to say that, in spirit or in whatever. And that's something I think a lot of people in a lot of different places will be grateful for a long time.
And I went to Yonge, Arizona. I believe this is my mother in Tucson, and to visit a friend. And there was a guy there who had this little Zendo, and we went for a walk. And we talked about this meetings with remarkable women that had been written, and there was a chapter on Joho in that. And I kind of liked her. I never heard of any of these women. But I liked her because she was so plain. And because she had four kids and I had four kids. She was divorced. I was divorced. Anyway, this fellow, apparently who had been practicing in San Diego, gave me Everyday Zen. And I thought it was just while we were there. And I went home back to where we were staying and started reading it. And I read a lot of spiritual books, but I've never read anything like that. And it was just so powerful and so plain and so usable in ways that I had never found before. Apparently he gave it to me, and I kept reading it and rereading it. And then one day I asked the operator for the telephone number of the San Diego Zen Center, and I called the number, not expecting to talk to Joko, but there she was on the other end of the telephone. So I really didn't know what to say, except, I liked your book. And she paused and she said, "It's just a book." I thought, "Now, what do I say?" And I said, "Well, I think I'd like to do one of those sessions." And another pause, and she said, "Well, they're difficult, but useful." So I feel absolutely privileged that I went out to San Diego a couple of times to sit there and to have Daisan and Dokusan with her. Felt very enriched by having read her books, and I have all this time given to a paragraph here as support. She has such a clarifying voice.
Fortunate to have been a student of Joko's. She was my first Zen teacher. I'm very grateful for that. One thing that the video we just watched reminded me of was how Joko seemed like she was always trying to find new ways, different ways to help students, different strategies to help students think a little more deeply into what was really going on in their life and be aware. And the systems work, the core belief, I remember that. When I first started, she was doing something about the sort of sentence structure, I feel angry because, or something that was, again, just a way to own what was going on, recognize it, and then be with that, work with it. Last weekend we had a zishin in Springfield with Elihu, and Elihu read a piece about the function of a Zen center. One time, I remember Joko saying that the function of a Zen center is, I don't know if she said to make you angry or to, so you could see your anger, but it was something like that. And, when I first heard it, I think I wasn't really willing to recognize that. But then as time was going on, I see the value of that, because if I can, recognize the anger that comes up for me in a sangha situation, it's a lot easier to work with it than when I'm outside, in a work situation or home life or family situation, something that maybe where people aren't trying to work together. So as time's going on, that's one thing I really appreciate about the sangha, people coming and being together and working together, and it just deepens my appreciation for Joko, her teaching, and also being able to work with Elihu. Thank you.
Joko came into my life indirectly through my husband. My husband was sitting with Sue in the Evanston Sangha, and he and I would, he read her books, and he was sitting, and we would talk a lot about Joko's teachings. We would read together sometimes, and it really transformed his life. And working with Elihu, he never came down to do a session here. He was kind of wary about that. But his practice affected me. He died 5 years ago of a massive heart attack. And after that, I started to sit with the Evanston Sangha and reading Joko's work much more closely. It has very much complemented my, I'm a psychotherapist, and so my work with people, my thoughts about life and death. Very grateful to have been touched by her and to be a part of this community on whatever basis I am. Thanks.
Trying to get home from D.C. and with lots of flight delays and cancellations. And what I did all during that time when I wasn't standing in line and dealing with it was I was just writing. I had a netbook and I wrote and wrote and wrote everything that was coming up about Joko. And so if you'll just bear with me, I have all these pages and pages of stuff. I knew her for 35 years, and so there was just a lot that came up. And it's funny, I haven't seen that video all the way through, but some of the stuff in there was stuff that I had written, like the time she wanted me to feel her muscles, for Pilates. there it was. In my case, she actually dropped her pants because, she couldn't pull the pants like up high enough, though. She was just a very playful person and just delighted by all sorts of things. I wanted to just go back. I met her in 1976 in San Diego, and my Uncle Richard was a Zen student, and at that time he sat with the San Diego Sangha, or just a loose group of people that studied with Maizumi Roshi and drove up to Zen Center of Los Angeles. And so he had told me about her in advance, because he described her as one of the heavies in the Sangha. And so I had read Three Pillars of Zen, and I was really kind of fixated on the whole enlightenment thing, and he told me that she had, you know, this, at least one major enlightenment experience. So I was really sort of in awe of her and afraid of her. And so when I first met her, I just really didn't know what to say, but she was just immediately accessible and friendly, and there was just this this look of amusement, which she just greeted everybody with that look. It was just this, you know, oh, like, what great thing has the cat drug in this time? You know? And that's the way she was when you would go and present whatever your tale of woe was. She was just delighted. And I think she was just really entertained by people's all of people's dramas, and then always, but always, always looking for a way to assist people in reframing what was going on with them, and putting it into a context. It really wasn't so much therapy as it was helping you see how to see through what was going on with you. One of the really most interesting things I was privileged to witness was how she became a teacher. And it's a lot like what she described in her work situation, where at work people were lining up to talk to her. And this is what happened at CCLA. She moved up there, I think sometime in 1976, and I moved up there a couple of years after that, maybe a year and a half. And so we worked in the same building, and she was Roshi's secretary. She had a small office with a doorway facing the hall, and she sat behind the desk, and the door was always open, and people were lining up. This was before, and she was, everyone knew she was a senior student and all that, but it was just something about the way she interacted with you. People were lining up. You would kind of walk down the hall, and you'd look in, and you'd see if there was anyone in there, and usually there was someone in there. A lot of times Elliot was in there. And, really. So then you would just, if you got sort of frustrated enough with there not being any, you know, an absence in there, that you would walk in, you just would stand kind of close to the door. But you give the person some space. You knew that those conversations were private, so you'd stand near the door, and then if it just went on too long, you would kind of inch up closer and closer until it was obvious that it was, you know, time for that person to leave. And so I think just because of that, and I don't know, I think that it was really what I felt I was seeing was life manifesting as a teacher. And no one didn't make Joko a teacher. She didn't, you know, didn't have anything to do with what she did or what Roshi did. It was just, life was just emerging as a teacher, and it was just amazing to see that happen. So she had Dharma transmission, I think it was 1983, and soon after that she left and went to San Diego. By that time, LU and I were married, and we followed her to San Diego. and go and work with her there. Bear with me for a minute here. One of the things about her, people were always hanging around, obviously, but it just didn't really affect her. I mean, I never saw her. She was never arrogant or smug or self-important, not in the least. And this was really in contrast with a lot of other senior students and even Dharma successors. And she was just always a very ordinary person who was interested and wanting to help. And one of the things she said that I just got a big kick out of was she got this, once she got, I don't remember what we're talking about, she got this kind of disgusted look on her face, and she said, we don't want to go around with our practice hanging out. Sort of like, you know, how tacky is that? Like something you need to sort of make sure you always keep to yourself. So many stories. What really mattered to Joko was how people were in their lives, how their relationships were going. That to her was an indication of their practice. And so I think some of you know Mike Andrzejczyk. I went and talked to him a couple weeks ago about this, and he said it was okay. I could tell this story. He had an aunt who lived in New Jersey, and she was starting to deteriorate. She was going blind, and there was some dementia kind of creeping in, and he and his wife Kathy had talked to her about coming out. He would like to, you know, bring her out at some point, but she was very resistant until one day the phone rang and she said, "You need to come and get me right away." So just all, you know, out of the blue, Mike and Kathy went out there, cleaned up her house, which was quite a mess considering she was not seeing well and having a lot of dementia. There was just a lot to deal with there in the house. So they cleaned it up, they took care of it, they brought her back, and I think she was in an assisted living home here somewhere in town, and going, you know, went to visit her regularly, and he, you know, I remember at that time him talking about how he would go and hold her hand and some of the things she would say. Sometimes she would know him, sometimes she wouldn't, but he kept going back. So I was telling Joko this, and she said, "That is a good practice." And to me, that's what came up when I first started thinking about Joko and what kind of summarizes her approach. She was very practical too. I remember I went to law school after 10 years being out of school, and we had a 1-year-old at the time, and so we moved to the town, and I started going to school, and about 2 months after I'd been going, I was just in a state of panic. It was horrible, and so I called her up. And I had really agonized over this, and I had decided that this was just wrong, and I needed to leave. So I called her up, and I said, "Joko, I've made a terrible mistake. This is so wrong. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know what they were thinking. I need to drop out." And so there was this silence on the other end of the line, and then she said, this very mild voice, she said, "Well, have you gotten any grades back?" And I said, no, you don't get grades until the end of the semester. And she said, "Well, don't you think you ought to at least wait until you get some grades?" right back. And it was just such an obvious, you know, just those, just that simple suggestion kind of turned it for me, and I felt like, okay, well, yeah, you know, I'll just be here now, and I'll just be with all this panic and anxiety, and I won't worry about doing anything, but I'll just be with it, and then we'll see what happens next. So she was just very, very practical. One of the things I loved about Joko was how she was, and Faye mentioned that she was always looking for new angles, new techniques. It seems to me like she had this magic bag, and she would just pull stuff out of it. And I don't know where it came from. Just whatever she felt might work to assist students in cutting through or seeing through the emotion thought that was gumming up the works. And she read widely. She embraced other disciplines. She recommended other teachers' books, various other approaches. I was trying to remember some of the ones. There was a book called Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life. And there was something called the Sedona Method. And when I first met her, she was encouraging everyone to go to Est. I don't even know if Est is around anymore. But that was really a big thing. We all went off and did Est. And so she really appreciated the Diamond books, the Almas books, and the Enneagram. She really had fun with that. So it was just a sort of a parade of different things that she would suggest people do. And also she liked to go to movies. I remember when Apocalypse Now came out, she encouraged everyone to go and see that movie because she said that the colonel or whoever it was that she said he was enlightened. And she repeated what he had said about the horror. I mean, the idea being that he had totally embraced the horror. We all went to, you know, we all went to the movie and watched, you know, the guy. So it was a lot of fun. She also made up some of her own tricks. When I remember at one point she was having people sort of lift their hands up like this, and you just would hold your arms up, and then you would notice whatever thought was passing through your mind, and you feel whatever bodily sensation was associated with that, and then you would just drop your hands in your lap, like plop. And at the moment that your hands plop down, you just try and just totally be that. So in the Zendo, then we would have people just. One of my favorites was, and that I still use, and I think it may have come from a book, was you imagine that you're sitting in a darkened theater, and you're on the screen is whatever emotion you thought, whatever drama, whatever story is going on, whatever comes up. So you just watch that play, and then you say, you just acknowledge it and you say, that's fine, just keep right on going, but I'm going to watch every single piece of this. And somehow bringing that focus is very effective. That was good. I don't know, I think I'm beginning to ramble and I'm running out of stuff to say, although there's always more. She liked to do pattern interrupts, I guess I would call them. People got too used to things. At a certain point, she took the Buddha statue off the altar and put on a rock. And thereafter, there was just a rock on the altar. The Buddha statue never came back. During session once, I remember she decided we were going to have bread and water instead of the usual lunchtime meal. So no one knew this, except being the practical, compassionate person that she was, some of us knew, and I knew, she told me because I was pregnant, and she wanted me to know this was happening. It was just going to be bread and water, but I should go to the kitchen, and that they knew I would come, and that they could just, you know, whatever I felt I needed. But otherwise, it was a complete surprise. People sat down to lunch, and along came the servers, and there was nothing in the bowl but slices of bread, and then pitchers of cold water. And then she just sat back and watched with amusement. It was like she just couldn't wait to hear what people would come in and say. Yeah. She enjoyed that. That's about all.
Watching the video, I was reminded of several things about her. And one of them is she loved to watch tennis on TV. I think she'd rather be watching tennis on TV than just about anything. And we would talk tennis because I played tennis when I was young. And her favorite player, I don't know if it was her favorite player, but she particularly appreciated John McEnroe, which kind of horrified me. Reminded me of the Colonel Kurt story, the Apocalypse Now thing. Maybe like the last guy I thought that she would admire, but she loved him because he was very much himself and kind of broke a lot of the taboos in tennis, for better or for worse, about behavior and how he was on the court and so on. And she took great delight in his antics, I think. I remember very well my first meeting with her, which was by phone. And I found a group here in town that was meeting every week, sitting in somebody's living room. And on one weekend a month, there would be a little mini weekend session. You'd sit all day Saturday and part of Sunday. And I believe it was Sunday morning we all had a chance to talk to Joko by phone. And I'd read her book by then, and I knew a little bit about her. So I waited my turn, and when my turn came in, I went into the little bedroom off the living room, and there was the phone sitting on the table, off the hook, waiting for me. And I sat down and took a deep breath and picked up the phone, and I was told to say who I was, what my name was, my full name, and which I did. And I don't remember what I said, but I remember what she said. She first asked me, well, why don't you just tell me what you understand about Zen practice? Just give me in a few words what you're understanding. And I rattled something off and kind of held my breath. And she said, oh, okay. She said, well, this is a difficult practice. And she said, if you stick with it, it's going to transform your life. Just like that. I said, okay. All right. She says, but you need a teacher. And she said, I can be your teacher. Just like that. Fine. Okay. But she says, I want you to sit every day for half an hour in the morning. And I'd like you to call me every week. And she said also that I'd like you to try to do as many sessions as you can. And she says, I know you're a long way away, but she said, I don't want to hear any complaints about airfare. She said, I don't hear any about that. Just come when you can. So I started to go out there maybe once or twice a year. And I remember my first personal interview with her, which was shown in the video, that setting, which all came back to me. And I remember our first interview, I was very nervous, and like Elizabeth, I think I was kind of intent on coming in with something that would impress her. And I was asking her what I thought were pointed, important questions. What about emptiness and such things like that? And she answered politely, and then at some point she said, so Jeff, you got a girl? And so that was, again, that threw me. Often we do that. You just kind of throw your back on your heels. Make you laugh. Laugh at yourself. We had lots of moments like that. Where she would say things, as Ezra said, she said something that kind of turned everything 180 degrees. Either right side or upside down. It didn't. It just felt like. And she would do it very simply and directly. And for me, I remember she said to me once, your job, you know, it's not your job, you have to make people happy. And I thought it was. I mean, I was raised to think that's what I'm here for, is to make other people happy. She said, no. So, lots of things like that.
I just actually want to express appreciation to Heidi Van Gunder, who is the woman who organized this small group of us, who, you know, in and out, grew over time, changed some ups and downs, obviously, that I won't, you know, say that much more about, but I really do think of her, you know, so tied together with all of this. I really appreciate, you know, how it was that she helped, you know, so many of us here locally access Jogo. You know, she came to visit. I don't even think I was sitting yet, but, you know, I heard about this visit, you know, Jogo was making to Heidi, and, you know, came to hear her speak. You know, I didn't know what kind of you know, I didn't know anything from status, who she was really, actually, before I got, luckily, you know, some access to her that probably other people would, you know, think is to die for. But, so, I, you know, it does make me think of Heidi, and I do want to express what I did. But as far as Jogo, a lot of what I'm feeling is, I suppose, very private, or not even that private, but, you know, I don't know how to put it into words, but, you know, that's, there's something about that non-dual thing that Zen is, because she was so special and yet nothing special. I don't know, you know, I mean, I know I had all this kind of, and I still have just this feeling of affection, and, you know, there was some kind of magical quality about going out to San Diego. You know, it really was something that, at least in quotes, I would call special, and, you know, it was really neat to be able to do that. And she just had that sparkle in her eye that you can even see on that video. I mean, there was just something about the way she communicated, and just the way she was, and her presence, and, you know, what that was and enabled other people to do. And I really appreciated that she didn't want people to deify her, because that would be really easy to do. And, you know, I don't know how to say this, but I'll just do it the best I can. I mean, there were, what's interesting to me, and that I think of, because it's all a part of all of this, is, you know, that there were some issues and falling out, and both here locally and then, you know, ultimately in San Diego. And it's just all fascinating and interesting to me. And as she mentioned, some things with, you know, traditional Zen teachers. And I don't know what I want to say about that exactly, but it's just really interesting to me. And yet, you know, there was this person who, I guess it just sort of reminds me of the totality of all of us, you know, how we are. You know, both, I can't remember who it is that has that poem. Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, I guess it is, that always speaks to me about how, you know, we have both the good and the bad, and the ups and the downs, and just, you know, that I guess what was so special about her was that there wasn't anything special about her, and that she wasn't a god, and that she was just a human being, but such a human being, like, you know, the word
Mensch comes to mind, and that's really all that means, is a human being. That's what it reminds me of, is that, you know, it really is about embracing all of it. And, you know, I haven't seen her for a long time, so I don't even feel that closeness that I once would have felt upon her death, I think. So I can't say that I miss her in the same way that probably others who were closer to her do it at the time of her death, but we are just so lucky to be working with her. And I think missing is the wrong word, but I think it is appreciating, really just appreciating so much what she is and was.
Bread and water story makes me think of the toothpick. Another thing that she said one time that she thought was hilarious was, well, I should just have everybody eat their soup with a toothpick. And she just, and I thought about that and I thought, God, that would make me so mad. So stupid. But of course, then I thought more about it and I thought, okay, whatever. I read Joko's book because I was a runner who couldn't run, and that had been my religion, if you want to call it that. And her book completely baffled me and absolutely attracted me. So I told my husband and our two tiny little children I was going to California to a session, and he told me later that he thought I was leaving and I was never going to come back. I was going to be a hippie and run away. The first session I ever did was completely overwhelming because I absolutely had no idea what to expect. I was uncomfortable the entire time, which of course Joko would have thought or did think was good. And when I came out of it, I couldn't remember my home telephone number. I mean, I was just completely, I don't know in what state. And somewhere along the line, she had said, well, once you go to sessions, you start to feel pretty much the same all the time. Well, that was the feeling that I thought I was going to have all the time. The second session wasn't anything like the first session. But the moment of Joko that I really remember was going in and, you know, having my airy-fairy head going on and talking. And she said, well, tell me what happened to you today. And of course, you know, you're in session. What happened? So the only thing I could think of was, there was this little thing where the server came around and I didn't know what gesture you were supposed to do to say, no, I don't want any, thank you. And I didn't do it. And so he stopped and corrected me. And I was pissed off. And she jumped on that with both feet as, this is what you're here for. And it took me years to understand that. But I do. And she was... I mean, all the things everyone has said about her are all true, plus a whole bunch more. And it's just amazing to me what an incredibly voluminous, radiant presence she was in the most, you know, plain B-flat clothes and, you know, talking about lipstick. And she was really an incredible woman. Thank you. Talked about picking out lipstick color and liking it to match her fingernails. I was like, what? Fingernails? Zen, man. No, it wasn't. I mean, I didn't say that to her, but when she was talking about lipstick, that was
what is it, having a thought. That was the thought. I mean, she, it's the same as asking Jeff about his girl. It's just she was like there.
But I have a story about makeup. I went into Daisan once and I sat down and she was very nicely made up. And so I complimented on her on that and she said, well, I wasn't really all that interested, but Brenda looked at me and said, Mom, people have to look at you. So there she was. She had, you know, she had gone along with this. Not for herself, but for us. I thought that was really
Well, I'm from Springfield, and the only experience that I've had was the opportunity to hear people read from her books, because that's what we did when I first started. And at Thursday night and Saturday morning, we read a chapter from Nothing Special or Every Day's End, and not in order, just flip the book open and read it wherever it landed. And it was just special hearing her voice come through there. And I was hooked then, and still there after 6 years now. So, but I appreciate those opportunities and this sangha and sitting here with everybody. So, thank you.
I never met her, but I took a class here, and it was a class on her books. And one class we had a reading, and she talked about her life when she was trying to get 4 kids to daycare and have a job, and so she used the words, you know, just think about what's required. What's required for you to get through? So I have that on my mirror in my bathroom, and I see that every morning. And I have it on my desk at school when I work with children and reading. Sometimes I need that, what's required to get through the session. And so she's with me every day. Every day. So I'm very grateful for her.
It's interesting that you made yourself a little note, because that's what she used to do. She got me started doing that. Make just, you know, something that grabs you and sort of helps you. You like just type it out and put it somewhere where you'll see it.
I tell them all the time in Dharma talks and elsewhere, so I'm not gonna. This is time for everyone else. It's okay.
hesitant talking because I haven't been here in several years, but it occurred to me that I also feel very fortunate that I've sort of had the benefit of her teaching. And the way I came to it was seemed very strange. At the time, I was in New York City at my brother's apartment, and I was just looking at his bookshelf, and he had a bookshelf full of books about Zen Buddhism. And I was taking one out, looking at it, putting it back. He came over and he says, yeah, if you're interested in this stuff, you should really look at these two. And he went like this, and he pulled out her two books, and he handed them to me. And I said, well, we're going back to Champaign tomorrow. He said, just take them with you. Those are really good. He said, those are really easy to access, and, you know, Joko's the one. And it turned out he had known somebody similar to Ellie, who had been her student in New York. So I brought them back, read them, and thought, wow, this is great. And sort of put them on my bookshelf and kind of thought, well, I'll just have to do this by myself. And I was, a few weeks later, leafing through what is now, I think, The Buzz, the local rag, and I see this little tiny ad that says the Prairie Zen Center, lineage of Charlotte Joko Beck, and I just kind of went, whoa, that's weird. Because I had already thought it was weird that, for me, there was sort of a strange connection because she'd gone to Oberlin as a piano major, which I had too. So I always felt like there was some kind of hand in it for me, that somehow the unlikely connections that had me connected here seemed like I had to do it, like it was meant to be, and I'm very grateful.
It just occurred to me, you're going to back me up on this, that often I have an idea or find a book, read it, and start to talk to Rob about it, and that he will read it and carry it, you know, 20 miles further. About 15 years ago, I was referred to Bjork Holte with a myriad of complaints about pains and aches and stress and all kinds of things. And she recommended many wise things for me to do, and one of them was to read a book called Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. She gave me a copy and said, he'll bring it back whenever. And I thought, that's very trusting. You know, I like that about her. So I took the book home and I started to read it, and I thought, that makes sense. That makes sense. That's pretty wise. Oh, that really makes sense too. You know, and it was, and I started talking to Rob about it. And so I went on with my life just trying to incorporate a thing here or there, but Rob's not like that. And he read it and thought, I have to get to a Zen center. I have to learn how to sit. I have to, you know, make a roksu. If he hadn't carried it all that much further, I would never be here. And the benefit that I have had in my life from being associated with the Zen Center is it's irreplaceable. You know, it's wonderful. And so I appreciate Joko from the inside out. Thank you.
say that wait, in this pause that I was thinking of the stories I heard, and all of these stories I will carry back with me and remember them in other pauses. So I thank you all for sharing what you have shared. So
San Diego, I'd done a weekend session not too far from here with another teacher and sat all day, but this was a 6-day session, and it was really hot, very hot week, and they didn't have any AC out there, and I was really scared, and I was stressed out of my mind, so like the third day I was in bad shape. I was physically not in very good shape, and I was a little panicky, and I wanted to see Joko, and I said, "Joko, I feel like I'm dying," and she just laughed. That was great. And she said, "What did you expect?" She said, "I think you'll be okay. You look okay."
We went to a memorial service for, I guess, a Zen teacher, and there was a visiting teacher there who was asked to say some Dharma words, and he didn't really say much. Mostly what he did was just give one of those Dharma shouts, you know. So later we were talking, and she said, "Well, that was safe." That was her assessment.
About a man who jumped out of a building, and by the time he got to the fifth floor, he was heard to say, "So far, so good." I remember that. I remember that periodically.
Is that the same guy who, as he's fallen, is saying, "You know, I wonder how I look," and, you know, he's falling a certain way?
Yeah, that's from the homage from the Magnificent Seven. Yep. Stephen Queen is telling that story to someone in the Magnificent Seven.
Once Faye and I went to the Bloomington, Indiana, Dalai Lama as a brother there. And we couldn't get in, but I think they must have broadcast it, I think, so that we could hear him speak. And I believe the way this went is I think I remember telling
telling Jogo about it, that we had done that, and she said something like, I wouldn't walk across the street to see another teacher. I just, you know, it's part of that way that she didn't deify people. I really do appreciate that. Another time, Faye and I went up to Minneapolis, and it was right after 9/11, and it just happens to have been, October of 2001 that Joko was speaking there. Just remember going up to see her, hear that talk. I remember asking her something about how you deal with something like a terrorist attack. I don't remember exactly how that exchange went, but she said something insightful. And, what's interesting is I do sort of think I remember some kind of caution about, of course, what exactly what we turned around and did, which was, fight fire with fire and all kinds of crazy things that people do when they don't practice. Just the circumstance and the kind of administration we had then. But then we got to actually spend some time with her a little bit afterwards, which, I just can't resist calling it special. Not something I expected that we were going to be able to do, but she was, Brenda was with her, I think, and she set aside some time so that Faye and I could just, talk with her privately for a little while. So nice to be able to do that. It's great.
The thing about that time, she gave a public talk. She was going out there to work with Steve Hagan, I think is his name. That evening she gave a public talk, somebody, she opened up to questions, and somebody asked her a question about 9/11. I believe it was something like, can you speak to karma in 9/11? And she said, no. And that was it. Just very clear what she would and wouldn't do. Just very clear, but that was it. No. I really appreciated that about her. I was practicing Aikido. I love Aikido, and I got hurt, and I never would go to somebody like Bjork, I thought muscle therapist or massage, and never something like that, because I love Aikido so much that I had to go and get this fixed. And so I went to see Bjork Holtay. Somebody said she'd be helpful, and after a couple of years of seeing her, I said I was going to move into a. I was going to move from one apartment to another. I was renting at that time, and I was going to have a quiet room, like her office. And she said, well, if you like my office, then maybe you'd like to come to our sitting room. And that's how I first heard about the place that Joyce referred to earlier, that Heidi was organizing this little sitting room. And that's where I went there. Just coincidentally, I'd actually met Heidi through something else. But I went there one night, and it was the next week, that was my first introduction, and then the next week, Joko came to visit with Brenda. And so I did get to meet her first in person. But it wasn't until that was in the fall, maybe October. And then the following February, I decided to call her and see if I could be her student. That was my introduction to her. And then as Jeff mentioned, we would go to these monthly had these weekends retreats, and we would call her. We had an opportunity to talk to her on the telephone. And then I actually was fortunate, just so happened, my professional association conference was held in San Diego that very spring. And so I went to the Zen Center of San Diego just to see what that was about. And I remember I was ill, I had a cold, and I was sitting there in what we call Doksan, Daisan is what they called it. I was sitting there, and she put her hand on my face to show me something. I was like, I have a cold, don't do that. But, you know, it was like, no, you know, it was okay, and nothing, you know. She was like, just, like, all these germ things that I had going on, and she wasn't there at all. She was but at any rate, and then I went out in August for the Sashin, 6-day Sashin. Thank you for asking.
Did any of you ever overlap out in San Diego? You know, you went to San Diego, you went to San Diego. I mean,
yeah.
Did any of you sit together out in San Diego?
Yeah, sure. Mr. Sheen.
I sat one session with Karen, and you were very pregnant. With Gabe. I mean, I was amazed that you were doing. You did the whole session, I remember, close to it.
We went out one time, the first one was Tony Bertoski was there, and Jason might have been there. Jeff was there, and Bjork was there, and Heidi. Yeah, we were there that time. But, there were times, and I don't know what else there was this one time.
Yeah, in that picture, actually. The woman who's the Psychiatrist,
Abigail's in that picture too, and I was that when Abigail lived here?
No.
Already, or was
she
not?
That was before she lived here too.
So Jeff, the session where you said you were dying, you know, your very first session, was anyone else in Champagne
dead? I don't remember. I think so. I think my memory is not totally reliable. I think I was not alone out there.
Well,
In that sense. Although I felt completely alone.
I understand.
The way they did things there was a little more rigorous in that about maintaining silence and not having any kind of social contact. And at least I was very careful to observe that at that time. So I was feeling quite alone. So this human contact I had with Joko, which was, you know, at the time what I thought was human contact, was really important to me. It was like, otherwise I felt at sea. And we had the other thing that I looked forward to greatly was in the evening, right after dinner, before dinner, there'd be an organized exercise period out on the grass in the backyard where there would be somebody leading, and he would actually talk like a human being and give us instructions, and that was another life preserver for me for those first few days. So I remember that so clearly, that kind of trauma of doing something like that, which was completely foreign to me, and the physical and psychological demands that felt like it was placing on me. So I think I'm more aware of that now for people who come here for the first time, even for a first sitting. I can, possibility that that can happen for other people as well.
So if I had smiled the way I do when I pass someone in the hallway here during the sheen, what do you think she would have said to me?
I don't know. She wasn't around that much in the Zendo, but there were monitors and people, senior students, and I was corrected a few times, kind of curtly. But that's okay. You know, it was just the style.
Another thing, just another story. When I went out there that April for that conference, I was struggling with bowing because I'm Jewish, and I felt bowing was not appropriate even though there was a rock in the altar, and she pointed it out. She said, you know, it's a rock. What do you think it is? And, you know, that's when Elihu had just received Dharma transmission. It was not that long after that. And she said to me, well, I've got this student who I think you should meet. And then she told me about it. I didn't know what that meant, but she said, you know, just hit that. But she said, I think because he was raised that way, and he could help you. He might be able to help you. And that's another thing about her. She was just so generous. It wasn't all about what she could do. If she knew somebody else who could help somebody with practice, then she would try to guide them to that person. And I remember that very first time that we talked and what you suggested. And how you embraced it, too. You know, but yes, that's difficult. By bowing with it at home, no, you're not the Zen center. But that was just another tribute to both of you. In particular, though, the fact that she didn't push it away. She didn't feel that silly, you know, get used to it, which is the type of thing that I would normally do, you know, just try to push it, not acknowledge it, not be with it. But she was always about being with what's coming up in skillful ways. I really appreciate that.
On the way here about another little group that I interact with in Springfield, a group of women, and there's some men in this group as well. But we would probably at this point, or when the bug was walking around the floor, and probably still here with us, say, we see you, Joko, as you wander around and listen to Jeff and listen to Karen. And then we would say, thank you, thank you, thank you, Joko. We appreciate you. We love you. And we see you. We see you.
Joko in the film was speaking about her friend, and her, when her friend died, that for her it was anything but sad. And I remember that from the first time I saw that film, and then it occurred to me that, for me at least, it's a similar experience now upon her death, that it seems to be an occasion for celebration and joy. A life well lived.
That's a good way to end at this point. And I think doing the four practice principles, which, as most of you know, are her, well, she, along with one of her students, Alan Kapra, put it together as a restatement of the fundamentals of Buddha's teaching, or the Four Noble Truths, or just the nature of the reality of our life. So let's end this with doing that three times as we do, and in a sense, this is just a punctuation in our life practice, which is the best way to appreciate and share in her life practice.
Teacher, in just this moment, compassion's way.